Conrad Jobe, Tbilisi. This is Kielpod.com coming to you from our studios high atop Tbilisi's lovely Rustaveli Avenue. Today is Thursday, the 6th of December, 2012. On this day in 1240, the Mongols invade Kiev, which led directly to the development of Moscow, which was out in the middle of nowhere and therefore a little bit safer at the time. 1768, first edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica is published. 1790, U.S. Congress moves from New York City to Philadelphia. In 1917, Finland declares independence from Russia. In 1922, the Irish Free State comes into existence. In 1933, Ulysses by James Joyce is declared by a U.S. judge to be not obscene. And in 1953, Vladimir Nabokov completes Lolita. Birthdays today are Anton Korchkaladze, the writer, Alfred Eisenstadt, the photographer, Ira Gershwin, the lyricist, and Dave Brubeck, who died just a few days ago. We'll be hearing from him later. We are Cameron Christensen, Matthias Hooter, and me, Mark Mullen. Nothing we can say can be connected with any of our employers, past, present, or future. We also have with us guest Neil McFarlane, professor of international relations at Oxford, and an associate at the Center for Social Sciences here in Tbilisi. He also teaches at Tbilisi State University. We'll be hearing from him later on. My Georgian Journal and Kvitis Politra column this week is about seatbelts and the rule of law. Two quick things before we begin. First, an iTunes update. To get it, go to tbilpod.com, because some of you have been writing saying that you couldn't get at it through the iTunes store, which may be the case. We'll try and work on that. But go to tbilpod.com, scroll down to the screen on the right-hand side below all the list of tags. There's a little rectangular icon that says iTunes. Click it, and it'll work. We checked. Still have trouble? Email us or post a comment on the website. Second, we've now been on the air in our current format for a year and a half or so. We'd like to hear your input. What do you want more of? What do you want less of? Tell us your thoughts. Be nice, but we really would like to hear it. Put it on the forum or send us an email at tbilpod@gmail.com. The most useful comments will get a shout-out if you approve, because we never use sources or names, being responsible Georgian journalists. And you'll get a free lifetime subscription to Tbilpod.
Which is a pretty good deal.
Which is a great deal. Yeah. And absolutely fantastic.
And I would like to deny that I'm a journalist.
All right. Now, we're going to do something new. We've never really done this, so bear with us if there are technical complexities. But we're going to start off with a short BBC clip of an interview that I gave a couple of days ago from some part of the BBC. I'm not really sure which. Please listen to the pronunciation of the names that they have here. Okay, everybody ready?
Now, a few weeks after parliamentary elections in Georgia, President Saakashvili, I normally get that wrong, becomes a lonelier figure by the day. Even Shvili government is prosecuting more and more of former Saakashvili officials. And today starts at the trial of his former defense minister, who turned into an exile. His name is Unkaki Okurashvili. He left the country in 2007, returned a few weeks ago, and was promptly arrested at the airport for being wanted on various criminal charges.
Well, the former Prime Minister and ally of the President, Vano Mirabishvili, is summoned by the police for questioning about the alleged use of a fake passport. Bako Akalaya, one of the most powerful figures of Georgia's former government,
Bako,
has been charged with torture by the new authorities. So what is going on in Georgia? Well, Mark Mullen is the head of Transparency International. He's on the line now from Georgia and helps us to shed light on these issues. You're very welcome to the program, Mark.
Thank you.
So, it seems very complex and very complicated. Can you let us know basically what is happening and why all these arrests?
Well, I think this happens in a framework that's pretty positive, which was that there was an election, and after 9 years of service, the ruling team lost, and they admitted that they lost, and a new government has taken over, and that's pretty rare in this part of the world. At the same time, it was a pretty tough campaign, and the new team is pretty angry about a lot of things that happened during that campaign. For example, Ivanishvili, now the serving prime minister, there was a lot of problems with his passport that they said that what he had done was illegal and didn't allow him to do this or that, and so. Now, Vano Mirabishvili, as you mentioned,
it's Vano
to question his passport, and it's pretty pretty vindictive and pretty petty and maybe not very smart.
Is that the way it's seen by people there, as vindictive?
Well, they're, for a lot of people, it's quite popular, and they're very angry at the old ruling authorities, and they're as happy for as many arrests as there can be. A lot of other people are nervous about it and, you know, and support the former government. I think the international community, the tone from the international community is a little more nervous than it feels like here in Tbilisi.
And the President Chalikashvili famously stood up to
President Chalikashvili.
Hasn't this sort of won him any sort of popularity? And why has it resulted in his party not doing as well as it is at the moment?
Well, I think you know, Georgia has an attitude towards Russia, and the Kremlin has an attitude towards Georgia that there's not likely to be any friendship anytime soon. And I don't think that had to do with his loss very much. And I don't see that the new government is going to turn towards Russia in any serious way. Russia's occupying almost a third of Georgia right now, and they've been pretty clear that until there are some major changes, that there's not going to be a thaw.
Do you think Georgia is becoming a more transparent country? You are from Transparency International.
I think that the trend under the former government was positive in terms of public procurement and a number of other things. But at the high reaches of the economy, there were some very shadowy deals, and there's many too many companies registered in places like. Places like Bermuda, for example, and the British Virgin Islands, and places like that. It's really too early to tell. I mean, this new government has not been around too long, but particularly within the judiciary and the criminal justice system, which had been a real problem under Saakashvili, there are some early signs that they're going to be opening up that quite a bit, and that'll be a real step forward if they carry on with that.
Mark Mullen, joining us from Transparency International. Thank you very much.
So that was the BBC not doing such a good name. I mean, I got it. You know, the poor guy that had trouble with Saakashvili. You know, I know, but I really I liked Bacco the best. That was my personal favorite. So yeah, his point about how you know, because Misha was so anti-Russian, he lost the election and whatever, was not such a good one. You got some numbers for us.
No, I think he actually said, what I understood was he said the opposite, that it should have scored him some points. But it made me anyway want to kind of refer to some numbers.
Yeah, I couldn't get over the Chalikashvili part, so I wasn't really listening.
But basically I have, we've got research that's been conducted by the Levada Center. And in August 2010, the research found that 31% of Russians would disapprove of even permitting Georgians to enter into Russia. And just to give you a perspective on that, that was followed by Chechens, which came in at 38% of Russians didn't want them to enter Russia, Roma 35%, and Chinese 32%. In a later Levada's Center survey in 2012, 41% of respondents named Georgia as the biggest enemy of Russia. Now, on the Russian side, I thought it was pretty interesting. On the Georgian side, it's also pretty interesting to look at. In 2007, before the war, 57% of Georgians said that they wanted full political cooperation with Russia. In August 2009, following the conflict, 51% of respondents believed that it was still very important for the Georgian government to strengthen the country's ties with Russia. The survey was repeated in 2011. This is a survey that was conducted by the Caucasus Research Resource Center. 48% of respondents, so still holding strong, only lost 3%, believed that strengthening ties with Russia was very important. Also, 76% of respondents, of Georgian respondents, approved of doing business with Russians. Interesting to note, however, 51% of Georgians named Russia as the biggest enemy of Georgia.
Interesting. Okay, so let's move on. On November 30th, an investigation was launched into the former Prime Minister Vano Merabashvili's, Vano Merabashvili's alleged use of a fake passport. Interior Ministry said Merabashvili used a passport with his picture issued under the name of Levan Maisuradze at the Tbilisi airport while accompanying Misha on an official visit to Armenia. Merabashvili was questioned on December 1st, but the Interior Ministry said it continues the investigation because Merabashvili did not cooperate. Meijer released a statement saying, quote, the idea itself that Vano Mehmedvashvili could have used a fake passport during an official visit is so absurd, it's difficult to even comment on it.
And what is interesting is that if you type that, there's a database, a government database, where you can check if you're in the voter registry. And if you type in Levan Majsuradze and the passport ID number, there is such a person registered with that name and ID number, but apparently nobody has found him at the address where he's registered in Tbilisi.
I mean, they've got to correct me if I'm wrong, but Levan, yeah, I mean, Levan Majsuradze is sort of
probably pretty
Nino Chaparidze, or, exactly. You know, or, I don't know,
Georgi Chaparidze.
I don't know. Well, Chaparidze, there's not, you know, you got to go into deep Imereti to find out, but...
Yeah. But the passport number was matching.
Interesting. Yeah. Civil.ge reported that the parliament adopted a resolution yesterday which recognizes 190 people arrested and convicted on various criminal charges under the previous administration as political prisoners. 25 others were recognized as being in political exile. According to the resolution, parliament will develop legal mechanisms through which those on the list will be exonerated.
And I think there's a very broad range of people who are on that list. So there are some people who were jailed for beating up people, I think, after a discussion about the role of the church at Kafkasia a year ago or so.
Guys are on there?
Yes, those guys are getting out for, beating up people who just were speaking out their mind. There's people who were accused of, a mutiny or deserting.
Oh, and Provanik.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really a very broad range of people, and it's not quite clear, what... You know, like if there has been a sufficient evaluation of all these cases.
Yeah, I mean, Mukrovani is a complicated situation, but, the priests who came into Kafkasia that time in 2010, that was really horrendous. Sorry to hear that they're being considered political prisoners. At the end of last week, Tbilisi City Court once again dismissed the prosecutor office's request for Tengiz Gunava, the former head of the General Inspection under the Ministry of Interior, to be imprisoned for 2 months prior to his trial instead of releasing him on a 10,000 lari bail. This time he's accused of misappropriating 300 liters of gasoline. Gunava was arrested earlier in November on charges of drug use and illegal possession of weapons. As I've heard, there were pretty extreme regularities with his first arrest. Basically, heroin was planted on him or some kind of drugs, which was common under the national movement. Actually, it was common under Shevardnadze, too.
Under the Soviets, too.
Yeah,
it's probably
a long tradition. Not to mention the fact that actually shooting heroin is pretty popular in this neck of the woods as well. But, that doesn't mean that everybody who was caught with it was actually using it. So what was interesting is that this brilliant trick seems to still be around, but also that it seems to have not worked in that, the judge and the prosecutors disagreed with, which doesn't happen. In fact, I've never actually seen that happen where the prosecutors seek for something and then the judges just say, no, sorry,
I've heard some people who have been observing some of the trials recently, and they said that a number of judges have denied motions by the prosecutor. Yes. And if you take the last 2 weeks together, more motions by the prosecutor have been denied than in the past 8-7 years together. So that's really a new trend, that the judges play a much stronger role than they did before.
Or the prosecutors are less competent. Prosecutors
are extremely competent. I mean, because they were so horrendously powerful, there was unbelievable competition to become prosecutors. I mean, they're smart and they know what they're doing. They may have become a little bit lazy since their main role was just to tell the judges what to decide. They might not be trying as hard, or they might be trying very hard. I mean, I don't know. It's just a very different situation, it seems.
Right. The other question is, who appointed the judges?
Well, the judges have all been appointed, pretty personally by senior national movement individuals, which is quite interesting. And we'll discuss a little bit later when we talk about truth and reconciliation. But I mean, there has been a decision that the judges will be left alone and are not going to be just replaced with those Sneba people, which is crucial. At the end of last week, Prison Minister Sosar Subadi asked Misha to pardon 137 prisoners who suffered from diseases that are difficult to treat in prison hospitals. President today pardoned 251. Who were given recommendations by the Patriarch. 23 of their sentences will be reduced, the rest will be released.
And it's also, I think it's quite remarkable that the Patriarchate is kind of the board that supervises who is going to be pardoned and who is not going to be pardoned.
Yeah, it's bad. basically. It's really bad. Former head of CUDI, Data Khalaya, and other officials, Soso Topuridze, Geron de Alania, and Oleg Milnikov, were sentenced to pretrial detention in absentia. They are accused of abuse of authority, namely... What are you correcting me? Everybody knew what the heck I was talking about. I mean, give me a break here.
Absentia is different from abstaining.
Well, okay, they are accused of abuse of authority, namely beating up policemen. I mean, really beating up policemen in some pretty creepy ways. Data Khalaya is also accused of illegal imprisonment of Mtatsmina Kurtsanisi Police Department officer.
And this afternoon, just before we started recording, the Ministry of Defense... went public that they found apparently a corruption case in procuring Kalashnikovs under Khalaya when he was defense minister, and they are implying that he made some money on the side while buying some Kalashnikovs overpriced.
Crazier things have happened. In fact, said Bako Akhalaya, former defense and interior minister, and former defense minister Irakleo Kurashvili were both moved to prison number 9 on Morozov Street, designed especially for convicted former employees of law enforcement agencies. Prison minister Subari said that there's no way that the two can come into contact with each other because Okurashvili would open up a can of, it would be an unpleasant experience were they to meet each other. Okurashvili and a group of 7 other defendants accused of forming an illegal armed group remain in custody. The 7 are Okurashvili's bodyguard, a former employee of the financial police, former chief of forestry, 2 security guards of the former Shida Kartli governor, Misha Kareli, which had been an Okurashvili ally for a long time, and former head of the General Inspection of the Defense Ministry and former head of Shida Kartli Military Police. The next trial will be held on December 10th, according to Interpress News. Yeah, for those that are getting appointed as the heads of general inspection of various power ministries, you know, make sure you're crossing all your T's and dotting all your I's. Just a little bit of word of advice from TabilePod.com.
Well, I believe that the general inspectorates are still subordinate to the minister and that their finances are determined by the minister. So I'm not sure to what extent they're incredibly
independent. Yeah, and at least in the old days, their health was tied directly to how enthusiastically or not enthusiastically they pursued their investigations.
I think this case regarding Okurashvili actually very much surprises me because I haven't heard about this at all before with him forming an illegal armed group. When did he form this illegal armed group?
2011.
It was in 2011, so when he was not here.
When he was running the opposition.
It was allegedly in 2011.
I mean, the guy really liked armed groups, you have to admit. I mean, he really enjoyed them a lot. Have you seen all those pictures of him? The rumor that I heard was that the week before Okurashvili got downsized was that when they were running the crosstabs on the most recent polls done by Greenberg and Rossner, that Okurashvili was substantially more popular with the demographic of young women. You know, they had all these Facebook pages, and they had, like, Okurashvili with, cigars and, fatigues, walking around looking super macho, and it was just, I don't know.
Putin-style kind of.
Yeah, well, Putin-style, it seems like it's so obviously a PR thing, whereas Okurashvili, it was sort of they moved the frame a little bit, and it was just like, ugh. It was
like an action movie.
It was like an action movie, yeah. And it was clearly a sort of, South Ossetia backdrop. It was just horrible.
But Misha Kareli actually already served jail time, remember? Because he was actually put in jail for corruption under the UNM.
That's right. Former head of the Border Police and Intelligence, Valery Chkheidze, returned to Georgia yesterday, according to Interpress News. He was the last Border Police chief under Chevy and was fired under Misha shortly after the Rose Revolution because he was an incredibly corrupt guy. Under his watch, lots of money disappeared. He left Georgia in July 2004 and has lived in Ukraine since. Supposedly, during the demonstrations that led to Chevy's resignation in November 2003, there were some chemicals that were going to be used to disperse the crowd that he didn't let them in and told people and, in general, was sort of helpful for the demonstrators, sort of keeping his options open. But he was still a very, very corrupt guy. He took money for ranks and promotions and jobs of senior officials, letting Chechens into the country and everything else, as was the way it worked in Shevardnadze's time. It'll be interesting to see if there's any investigations against him for what happened then, since that was pretty clear that that's how the border police worked then. The Channel 9 story, which is Ivanishvili's TV station, had that as the lead story when he came back, even before he came back, sort of saying like how nice it'll be for him to be reunited with his family and all of that stuff. So yeah. I don't know.
Maybe this will come up a little bit later, but what are the statutes of limitations on any of these things?
I don't know.
Corruption, I think.
Corruption in 2003?
I'm supposed to know. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know that.
Yeah. Oh, but it would be interesting to look up.
A couple of anecdotes that I've heard is that they tried to procure a helicopter for the border police, and they bought it from some shell company. $15 million were apparently spent. The helicopter never showed up, but the money was gone.
Yeah.
And the procurement of food that nobody could eat.
A legendary, In an administration full of characters legendary for their, fraud and corruption, he was legendary. New piece in the CarnegieEndowment.org, TPLPod.com, amigo Tom Duvall proposes to establish a truth commission for Georgia to, quote, strike a fair balance between the demands of justice and political fairness, as well as the pressures of time. Georgia should adopt a transitional justice process to deal with complex challenges. The approach should be similar to the ones applied in South Africa, Argentina, Timor-Leste, Sierra Leone, and Peru. Georgia's new Transitional Justice Commission can be endowed with a range of powers, including the power to summon witnesses and recommend that some persons be prosecuted in the criminal courts and others pardoned. The overall goal of the process is to make a definite break with the past by confronting the root causes of an abusive system and providing a historically grounded narrative about it. To borrow French philosopher's Ernest Renan's definition, its task is to determine what Georgia should remember as a nation and what it should forget.
I mean, I think that this is really interesting. I'm not an expert in this area, but transitional justice, I mean, I normally associate that with civil war or apartheid or incredible, just rampant injustice. And I'm not sure that, I mean, I'm almost surprised to hear this kind of applied to Georgia. I don't know if anybody else was a little bit thought that this was a bit of overkill.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people that are very ticked off. Some of those people lost court cases that they should have lost. Others of those people were treated unfairly and, had a kid, tossed in jail for a long time who picked up TB and came out a lot thinner and maybe not in such good shape emotionally. And they're angry about it. So how do you deal with that? Now, if you send them back to the courts, you're sending them to the same judges, who put them there in the first place. Now, maybe they're going to be better, but, there's an argument that, it's not going to be like probably as huge a process as Rwanda had to go through. But, I think there is an argument to sort of keep them out of the court systems and just, figure out what we're going to do here.
Right. But I think, what's interesting is the discussion, there's been this whole discussion about, justice versus revenge. And I think that there's been a lot of emphasis on, Georgian, the people who got kind of screwed over the last, 9 years,
this is a family show, Cameron.
That's legitimate.
That's legitimate.
That they want revenge. I hear this term. And I think that what we're really talking about is that people want to feel that they're, the wrongs are being righted, and the way that you do that is by, I've dealt with restorative justice, which is where you bring kind of the victim and the perpetrator together, and so that's not really what we're talking about here. But I think that's what people want.
And then for the victim to just smack the hell out of the perpetrator.
No, usually what it is that you have a group of people who are within the community who say, like, this is what happened. This is how it was wrong. This is how it made me feel. And then this is how it can be kind of, this is how we can react to it. And
well,
this is what needs to be done.
It seems to me like that's what they're saying. I mean, more or less. I don't know. I mean, I have not read the full report. But, it sounds like an interesting idea. I think there are a lot in the national movement who are like, come on, let's be real here, and I think, it's legitimate. I mean, what happened in Georgia does not compare, with what's happened in some other places. On the other hand, a lot of people feel wronged, and if they're not somehow dealt with, that, things could get complicated.
Yeah, this is, to me, is the real question. Would Georgians who feel themselves wronged be satisfied by a process of this type, rather than a more typical rule of law process, which results in indictment, trial, and imprisonment. I mean, my sense is that it would be a rough road to hoe.
Right. I mean, yeah, and I really think that the courts themselves are a problem, since everybody knows who these judges were that did this. And so if the judges themselves say, okay, now this guy is in prison, well, what's supposed to happen to the judge? The judge that actually made the wrong decision that the courts just said was a wrong decision. And then the last thing was, you know, retrying all of these things, you know, gets into complexities of double jeopardy that are going to cause issues mm-hmm. with the European Human Rights Court and God knows who else. So, you know, there's plenty of stuff to figure out here. Georgia refused to extradite Russian citizen Ahmed Chatayev, who was accused of weapons possession. He was detained in September in Laputa Gorge during a special operation of the Ministry of Interior that was just a giant mess. Chatayev was a representative of the Chechen Republic of Ichkeria, unrecognized secessionist government of Chechnya. Justice Minister Teod Tsoulikiani announced the refusal to allow extradition at a meeting with the residents of Pankizi Gorge, who were holding a rally outside the Justice Ministry demanding an investigation into Chatayev's case and his release. Today, Tbilisi City Court ruled a 5,000 lari bail for Chatayev. Defense Ministry will be allotted an additional 52 million lari by the end of 2012, filling the ministry's current budget deficit related to the purchase of some Kalashnikovs, perhaps. Parliamentary majority will support Uchin Nanuashvili for the position of ombudsman and not former Transparency International Georgia employee Nina Khatizkatsi. Nanuashvili has been leading NGO Center for Human Rights for many years.
And that's still, I think, widely discussed in the NGO community because originally the Georgian Dream said, you know, we will leave it to civil society to figure out who your favorite candidate is. There were a number of candidates, and a number of candidates went to public hearings and went through public discussions. But this didn't really have any impact on the first selection of Nina by the Georgian Dream, and now they switched to Ucha.
Right, and the clear favorite by everybody was Tamar Gurciani, who was really, I mean, felt to be very, very independent.
And competent,
I mean, well qualified for the job.
She was also the only candidate, I think, that really spoke out in favor of sexual minority rights, so gay, lesbian, transgender, and so on. All other candidates stepped away from that issue and said, oh, it's not an issue, you know.
And, yeah, some of them didn't step away. They stepped right into it and said, you know, we're on the wrong side of it.
Yeah.
It's not just that she has an issue for that. I mean, I think in all possible regards, she was the consensus candidate among, as it's called, civil society, whoever they are. And frankly, Otsneva just didn't care, which is not so nice. Now, that's nothing against Uchin Nanuashvili. I think there are some that have, some other concerns about him. But he was not the civil society consensus candidate. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, but I hope that this doesn't reflect upon how effective the Ombudsman's Office will be in the future. Because essentially what we've seen over the past 5-9 years is that the Ombudsman creates an annual report that is then properly dismissed by Parliament and where no one even attends. So, indeed.
Let's at least hope that they show up and that there's some follow-up. Colonel Irakli Dzneladze will be the new head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the Armed Forces. Misha and Defense Minister Irakli Alassani agreed on the candidacy. Dzneladze has served in the Georgian military for 20 years. Recently, he was a military attaché of Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, and Belarus. Previously, he held various positions at the Joint Staff. Dzneladze will replace Gheorghe Kalandadze, who's under investigation for abuse of power, and if you'll remember, had that fumbled arrest of a few weeks ago. Yuri Mechitov and Khatuna Kundadze will no longer be deputy ministers of culture, but they will remain in the ministry, according to the word on the street. The reason for Mechitov's dismissal was the video in which he speaks about the regional makeup of Georgia. As for Kundadze, it was because of posts she published in the pre-election on Facebook. I don't know. Can I read this?
No.
It's
a family show.
It's a family show. Yeah.
Just bleep the third word.
Okay. Misha, you...
Bleep.
Bleep. You were conceived by Satan and birthed by a zombie. I loathe you. Achalaya, there are no words in Georgian suitable for you or the mother who raised you. You are free to arrest me for insulting the president. I loathe you, stinking nationals.
I first off think that there are words in Georgian that are suitable for whatever she wanted to say.
Because
there are, Georgians have lots of words that they use. But I think that's really interesting. I didn't realize that this was during the pre-election period, but the fact that she was a private citizen saying something on Facebook, I find pretty weak evidence for her to have been removed for her from her position.
Yeah, but it was known when she was appointed. There was just no scrutiny of them, and they were apparently not able to delete,
quickly enough.
Quickly and change the privacy settings on their Facebook account.
But listen, that's fine. I mean, to make comments like Mechitov did about the regional makeup of Georgia, that's something that, you know, is a belief that should not be reflected in the Ministry of Culture. But for someone to have political disagreements and to use, abusive or, colorful language in order to express that on essentially a public forum, but which is private, I don't see why she should have been removed.
Well, I don't know. That's very commonly done here. I mean, the things you say on Facebook are, just cut and pasted and put into newspapers, all the time here. Whether or not that's good, I don't know. But everyone just keep that in mind for those of you youngsters who,
have it's not good. It's clearly not good.
I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying it happens a lot here, so that for someone to say that and to not, consider that is maybe unwise. And maybe it's not that she said that, but that she was sufficiently unwise to do that if she had any ambitions in a future government. Israeli Ambassador to Georgia Yuval Fuchs declared that Israel is surprised and disappointed at Georgia's decision regarding Palestine status within the EU, and Palestine was upgraded from a non-member observer entity to a non-member observer state.
Of the United Nations.
According to Fuchs, they had a dialogue with the Georgian government on this issue, but in the end, Georgia was one of the 138 countries supporting the change of status. There were 9 dissenters and 41 abstentions. Yeah. Hats off to the new regime for clearly doing the right thing here.
Yeah. The dissenters were Canada, the United States, the Czech Republic, and 6
not obscure. No, some of them were ones that have Nauru.
Nauru, great.
So one that has recognized
here's a couple $100. Can you do that? Whatever. Minister of Security of Shevardnadze's government way back when, Igor Girgadze, addressed the chief prosecutor's office in a statement asking them to delist him as wanted and allow him to return to Georgia. Girgadze plans to continue his political activities, political with air quotes, by the way, which is, of course, just what Georgia needs. For those who don't know, he's the one supposedly responsible for the 95 assassination attempt on Shevardnadze and in general being a Kremlin KGB stooge.
Isn't there a story that he was flown out by a Russian helicopter or something?
I'm sure.
Like that?
I mean, we all know who Igor Girgadze is. No questions there.
No, I don't think everybody knows who Igor Girgadze is. I mean, remember he was associated with the political party that was run by the woman Irina, whose last name is not going to come to me, but they were running. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know. The NDP.
Chanturia,
exactly.
Yeah. So,
Georgi Chanturia's wife, and that was the National Democratic Party, which was a very, an important party in the early 90s until its head was assassinated. She sort of carried it on, but it never really went anywhere. I think they were in some parliaments, had a couple of people in parliaments. Whether or not he was involved in them, I don't know. The guys he was working for was different than the party guys.
But this is the person that everybody constantly refers to when they say that Russia wants to plant a president within Georgia. This is the guy that they're talking about. And everybody always knew where he was. He sits in Russia and he was giving interviews and he was wanted, I believe, even by Interpol, right?
Well, sure, but the Kremlin has never cared about Interpol. I mean, yes, the interesting thing about him is that he typifies the complete and unmitigated failure of the Kremlin to ever influence Georgian politics. That they would have a guy like that was sort of their, the guy that they wanted. I mean, he's not going
to
be...
Right. But isn't there the person that Misha refused to keep in the Ministry of Interior, who is now in the deputy?
Who's back in, which is quite important. Khabardzhania, supposedly, as mentioned on tbilpod.com, you heard it here first. Khabardzhania was the Minister of Security, and when Misha went to go see Putin for the first time, and supposedly was an hour late to the meeting because he was in a swimming pool or something, not starting out on the right foot. Putin asked that he can you just do me a favor and keep Khabardzhania there, since he's my mole. And Misha answered equivocally and then came back and fired him. And one of his deputies who was working with him, Zuli, is now an interior ministry. And the people from the old Vano Medvedevsky interior ministry believe that that's no mistake and is evidence of cooperation. between the KGB-controlled Kremlin and the new regime. I don't know these people and have not met them, but you know, there is concern. Well, on December 3rd, Parliamentary Chairman Dato Subhashvili appealed to Chief Prosecutor Archil Kpilashvili to investigate video footage in which Ivanishvili's nephew, Emzar Ivanishvili, tries to bribe a police officer. On November 16th, Usupashvili was invited to Eka Kvesitadze's talk show, where he was shown the video as an example of the government's selective justice. In his appeal, Usupashvili demanded an investigation into who was the director, writer, planner, and operator of the video, which the MIA released during the pre-election period. Later, Ivanishvili commented on the video footage, saying that his nephew was a very unserious and unreliable person. He couldn't even trust him with a job, so he had to fire him because he lied too much.
Can you clarify the timing here for me? So there was a video during the pre-election period where Ivanishvili's nephew tried to bribe somebody.
Yes. And then that's being re-shown now, saying how come he's not being arrested.
Saying that he wasn't arrested even though we had the footage that we could have done something about it. But we elected not to pursue a case when we were in power as the UNM.
Right, because we preferred releasing videos, you know, before in the pre-election, you know, period.
But I really love how he just sold them up the river.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on the other hand, it's not like, you know, it's not like majoritarian MP from Zugdidi, Roland Bachalaya, is allowed to say about Data, like, oh, he's an serious and unreliable, you know, person and, you know, maybe slapped a few people around, you know, sorry, you know, that doesn't really work so well. 2 million lari will be allocated for the rehabilitation of the parliament building in Tbilisi. A draft amendment to the constitution was submitted to the parliament, which, if approved, would annul the operation of the parliament in Kutaisi. It's still unclear what will happen to the recently built parliament building in Kutaisi, which, according to the finance minister Khaduri, cost 340 million lari. For those who don't know or haven't seen the pictures on Facebook, I mean, literally just a week or two before the elections, the parliament building in Tbilisi, the interior was completely destroyed, so there's no way to occupy it right now. Why they felt they needed to do that is not clear.
People are saying it would be a pretty good university building.
Yes, there has been. Well, Millennium Challenge has got a sort of education focus this time, and there's talk about the technical university that was supposed to be in the sort of wacky Ferris wheel building in Batumi. Nobody really wants to do that. None of the partner universities were interested in that. So maybe the parliament building. But then there's the smell issue in the parliament building.
Yeah, and there's the rain issue as well.
And the rain issue and the roof issue and the karma issue. You know, so I don't know.
How did it cost 300 million lari?
340 million lari. I don't know, someone has to ask Chicovani.
By never publishing the contracts, by not really procuring it in a transparent manner, and by having it built by companies that are owned by, among other people, the head of the Georgian National Communications Commission.
And oddly, although this was largely government money, this building is owned by a private company?
Well, it was only government money, as far as I know, but it was maybe a government entity that was an outsourced government entity.
You got me. A level. Legal entity, public law? No idea. Next week, Parliament will also be discussing bills regarding products of a sexual nature. We mentioned that before, as well as amendments to the Labor Code, big issue, including an initiative that would make it a crime to force employees to quit, be punishable by 2 years in prison. We touched on both of these briefly last week. If, by the way, you want up-to-date information on what's going on in Parliament, I would highly recommend you sign up for this excellent service by the hardest working NGO in Georgia, Transparency International, free text messaging service. Go to parliament.transparency.ge, fill out the information, and TI Georgia will send you an SMS if something interesting is happening in Parliament.
Well, and the other thing is that Ivanishvili is establishing the Integrated Public Communications Department, which will inform the public about the activities of the Prime Minister and the government and to create a positive image of the administration. This political scientist, Valery Gorgiladze, is going to be the one who's considered for the department host. I just thought that those two stories should go together.
Okay.
So it's not only civil society that's providing information, but actually the new government is proactively deciding to... and reach out.
An argument took place in the village of Tsinskaro in Imereti, where local Orthodox Christians opposed Muslim Friday prayers. Later, the ombudsman's office released a statement calling on the prosecutor's office to carry out measures to protect the rights of the Muslim population in the village. Parliamentary minority and Gaila called on the government to defuse the situation and criticized MP Victor Japaridze and Soso Janjvaliani, who visited the village, where one local said there will be violence between the two groups and bloodshed, to which Japaridze responded, "That's inevitable."
Where's the patriarch?
Good question.
I want the patriarch to respond to this stuff.
I think he's on vacation.
I don't know if
absurd.
We really do want the patriarch to respond to this, because we can guess how he would respond.
That's related, by the way, to the choice of ombudsman.
Indeed. Indeed. I mean, I think, you know, that'll be an important question for the ombudsman, what they say related to the church.
Well, if he doesn't respond, we're essentially assuming that he supports Orthodox Christian crusaders.
Exactly. On Misha's orders over the past 5 years, the Orthodox Church was given 230,000 square meters of land across Georgia, and over the last 8 years, 116 million lari from the budget.
Yeah, the Orthodox Church had the covenant had a special covenant with the government, and if everybody remembers, there was the list of religions that would be recognized officially within Georgia that was recently updated within the last year. When I say recently, and apparently there had been like 230 religions that had been recognized, and I don't know if it had tax implications, but basically they decided to kind of narrow it down to almost none. I had meant to do a little bit of research on this beforehand, but I think it's now about 12 or so religions that are officially recognized within Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Georgia ranks 51st in Transparency International's 2012 Corruptions Perception Index, CPI, which just came out, measures perceived public sector corruption in 176 countries. Georgia's scores 52 out of 100 points. Which, with 100 meaning that the country is perceived as very clean. It's tied with South Africa, just ahead of Slovakia. Turkey is ranked 61st, and Armenia is ranked 129th.
Sorry, it's tied with the Seychelles, as far as I know.
Yes. Hmm?
It's tied with the Seychelles, not
the Seychelles.
Seychelles.
Uh-huh.
Also, right. We have interesting data at the COGS's Research Resource Center regarding bribery, and I posted this actually recently, but in 2011, the number of Georgians who reported that they had to pay a bribe in order to... Actually, I should just say that 99% of Georgians said that they did not have to pay a bribe for a service that should have been rendered for free, and the 1% did not know or refused to answer.
Hmm. Imedi TV resumed its news broadcast after a month and a half break. The decision to suspend broadcasting was made by company owners, the family of the late businessman Badri Patrikatsvili.
On Monday, I think the first newscast went on air, and it seems like they're now somewhat supportive of the new government's agenda. So before the elections, they were, of course, strong supporters of the United National Movements and were run by Misha's former chief of staff. And now it appears to be sympathetic to the new government. So,
mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to see how independent they end up being. Parliament is considering removing the right of the National Bank to supervise insurance companies. These functions would instead be provided by the State Service for Insurance. In addition to 15 million lari that will be allocated from the state budget to completely rehabilitate the Kutaisi Airport, state-owned airport, which is opened on September 27, is designed for low-budget air companies. Expenditures for the airport construction have not been disclosed. Tbilisi City Hall announces that it will, quote, resume social benefit funding, which was canceled by the central government starting in November, end quote. The subsidies are for the elderly to use public transport and allowances for utility and communications bills for poor people. 78 million lari had been allocated to the Tbilisi budget for 2012 to cover these expenses, but 6 days before being removed from his position as prime minister, Vano Medveshvili signed 3 decrees transferring the responsibility for implementing these social programs from the Tbilisi municipality to the Ministry of Healthcare and Social Affairs. On Halloween, Bidzina annulled all three decrees and requested the Tbilisi mayor's office continue implementing these programs with funds which were allocated to the Tbilisi municipality.
And this allocation shows us that next year is an election year.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Well, no, actually, I just want... I mean, this, I think, is really interesting because essentially it was like the municipality was trying to say, like, oh, you know, now we're going to give these all these things back to you, when it was actually the United National Movement that had taken them away from the municipality. So I just thought, like, that's really important to underline here.
Yeah, but the vouchers only come out in election years.
Funny how that works.
Yeah.
Tbilisi budget for 2013 includes 100 lari vouchers for public service payments, gas, water, electricity, and waste collection to every consumer registered in the capital. Socially vulnerable families will receive a 250 lari voucher. Minister of Finance Nodar Khaduri decided to allow the use of hidden cameras during controlled purchases and trade outlets in order to defend the revenue service from accusations of provocation. Under the previous government, representatives of small businesses often complained that tax officers provoked business owners into not giving them receipts and immediately fined the businesses. The current fine for not giving a receipt is 500 lari, but according to the revenue service, it will be decreased to 200 lari. Following up on last week's story about the statue of Stalin and what I wrote about in Fidesz Balitra this week, locals in Akhmeta declared that the statue will be opened on December 21st and Stalin's 134th birthday. According to locals, the statue was restored because of their own will and desires, and they will never allow it to be dismantled again.
Let's not forget that December 21st is also Misha's birthday. But what I wanted to say is that on Wednesday at 6:15 at the International School of Economics at Tbilisi State University, which is located on Zander Kelly Street, Lasha Bakradze will be doing a special discussion. It's called The Works in Progress, looking at attitudes towards Stalin. We've recently done some research on Georgians' attitudes towards Stalin, and if you're interested in Tbilisi, I would recommend that you go on Wednesday at 6:15.
Makvala Gonashvili, the chairperson of the Georgia's Writers Union, was declared persona non grata in Azerbaijan because of a trip to Nagorno-Karabakh. As Gonashvili decrees, she was invited to a poetry evening and not a political meeting.
Clearly shows she's also not politically astute.
Right. Yeah, exactly. If she cares about going to Azerbaijan. Tbilisi State University's campus was recently given 50,000 English language books to be housed in the American Georgian Library. The last big chunk of books they were given wasn't handled so well, and lots of them ended up disappearing, sadly.
But this one was donated by an American lawyer that I've never heard of before, but apparently his mission is to establish libraries in that region. So
fantastic. Good. Well, thank you very much, American lawyer. Patriarch of Georgia, Ilya II, will hold a 25th annual mass baptizing of children in December this year. Several years ago, he stated he'd become the godfather to every third and following child born to parents who were wedded in the church. The National Statistics Service reported earlier that there was a rapid birth rate increase because of the Patriarch's initiative. Purpur, the famous and very hip restaurant, closed in Sololaki on Gudiashvili Square, closed last Sunday night. It was started by Guga Kotetashvili, the artist. His partner was Otar Bagrationi, who gradually ran the place into the ground, sadly. So begins the great migration over to Shavi Lomi, or Black Lion, as the Utskoy Levy like to call it. It is on Davitashvili, so go there if you haven't been there already. Great place.
It's okay.
It's okay.
It's also owned by someone else. But I had heard that they were just renovating the second floor of Purpur.
Well, let's hope so, and that they, you know, that they get it together. I don't know. It's not confirmed. We never confirm anything. But let's hope it reopens and it's just some remodeling. Okay, now let's turn things over to our special guest star, Neil McFarlane, professor at Oxford and all around big shot. So, Professor, a couple of questions we wanted to ask. I saw you on Rustavelli, didn't know you were in town, and asked you to speak, specifically because some of the stuff that you've written about economics is just very, very interesting, and we don't know anything about economics and can never say anything interesting about it because we don't know anything about it. Not that that usually prevents people in Georgia. So we wanted to ask you, why does economics matter? I mean, big macroeconomics type stuff matter in a discussion of Georgian politics.
Thanks, Mark, and thanks for having me. In the first place, it is economics that dictates what resources the state has in order to do its business. In the second place, if resources are insufficient or if they're unequally distributed, we know that there are usually negative political consequences. The literature, at the risk of really being really boring, indicates that where a gap grows between people's economic expectations and their reality, they get mad. This is not surprising. It also shows that where inequality opens out increasingly over time, they also get mad. They get mad, you got problems. And this is directly related to the expectations, is directly related to the government's, to the Georgian Dream's election promises. They made a lot of promises about healthcare, social spending, pensions, education spending, all cost a lot of money. Now, you've raised people's expectations, and you don't have any money. So they got a problem here. And the question would be, because of the gap between expectations of the elections and what they can actually deliver, the question is whether the level of support that characterizes the current situation might reduce over time because people are not getting what they expected. And in fact, just one final point, I think that of the many promises, one that doesn't cost much money is justice. It's cheap. You got prosecutors, you got judges, admittedly of variable quality, and you've got prisons. So it's all fixed cost. It doesn't cost anything. It's very, very popular at the moment. And it sort of distracts people's attention from, let's redevelop agriculture, say, or let's up the pensions or reduce electricity and gas rates and so on.
And it has been cost neutral through plea bargaining in the past in Georgia. So the whole justice and prison system was...
Cost 100 million lari a year, they get 100 million lari a year out of it, and you know, there you go.
Not to mention a lot of employment.
Yeah. Right. It may have been cost positive, actually.
Expectations, sure. I mean, expectations, I think, you know, there's an argument that anywhere in the world, and certainly in Georgia, they will always outstrip, whatever the reality is. But, you know, there's a current vogue that I very much buy into of inequality being a big problem. And Georgia's Gini coefficient indicates that there has been rising inequality in Georgia and in the United States, by the way. So how has that happened? What policy-wise, by what means has that happened in Georgia over the period that it's happened?
Yeah, it's interesting. I looked at Gini coefficients earlier this afternoon, and Georgia continues to take the prize in the region. It has a more unequal score than either Armenia or, more surprisingly, Azerbaijan and also Kazakhstan. Now, you would expect inequality to be higher in energy-producing states because
corrupt
of rents and patronage and clientelism and a lot of cash. But no, Georgia takes the prize. How can this be? I think that it's not going up that much. It was always quite high. Since 2003, the level of inequality has been reasonably high. I think that it has something to do with the pattern of growth in the Georgian economy, particularly since 2005, where growth was high, but there was very little distributive effect. And consequently, you wonder, where did it go? I mean, the revenue, if you will, from growth, it's going into a small group of people who benefit from the system. And if you look at it, agriculture in the meantime, where, if I'm not mistaken, 47% of the Georgian population is rural. the agricultural sector during the period of the Rose, since the Rose Revolution, has shrunk remarkably. You may or may not recall that in 1991 it was 29% of the economy, and now it's roughly 7 to 8% of the total economy. And when you have 47% of the population basically producing and earning from 7 to 8% of GDP, obviously you've got a growing problem of inequality. It's just arithmetic.
So what about these election pledges? So can the government afford them? I mean, let's say Bidzina starts spending some of his own money on this. Does that matter? Because the way he talks, I think he recently said, well, we could have a government program to make big loans, or if not, I'll do it. You know, I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
In one of his lengthy sort of, you know, press conferences. I mean, how does that enter into it? And second of all, like with the, you know, in terms of FDI, how important is that? And what is the sort of, the prospect of with the bonds and that sort of that, I guess a year or so ago, they sort of rolled over a bunch of bonds and what is it sort of the macro picture? What does that look like?
Okay, well, first of all, with regard to Mr. Ivanishvili's money, the latest Forbes estimate is somewhere between 6 and 7 billion. Now, if you're going to start basically radically increasing pensions or essentially creating real universal health care, he's probably got about 6 years of money. And then he'll be like the rest of us, i.e. poor, okay? I wouldn't think he's going to do that. And besides, I think it's bad public policy because, again, it raises expectations in a manner that cannot be sustained without economic growth sufficient to finance those programs in the long term. I think that given the current state of the Georgian budget, there's some capacity for transfer. I mean, basically, somebody said recently, that they're going to, in the next budget, shut down Misha's jet planes and divert the the amount spent on Mr. Saakashvili's travels to health and education schools, right? That doesn't get you very far. And there's not much scope in the budget. And bear in mind that the tax take on Georgia's GDP is, I think it's 22.1% currently. You don't want it to go much further than that because it will depress growth. Because people who are taxed have less to spend.
And you saw, at least my impression is that the tax intake might actually decrease because there's, for example, a program that would give people a chance to win in the lottery when they would get the receipt. That program was ended by the new government. And
he loved that program so much.
Yeah,
so
it was an amazing idea. I think it was one of the best reforms
superb.
Ever. And,
absolutely.
And my perception is that you get a lot less receipts, meaning that a lot fewer shops are paying VAT.
Yeah, everyone we've been talking to has been receiving fewer receipts.
Absolutely.
Yeah. FDI.
FDI.
You asked about FDI. Let me go into FDI.
Foreign direct investment.
Basically, the external accounts of any country are pretty simple. You know, you've got money going out, and you've got money coming in. What are the big problems in Georgia's external accounts? One is the trade situation, which is, it's not exactly apocalyptic. It's somewhere between catastrophic and apocalyptic. I mean, they've got a huge trade deficit, okay? And this is basically running, I forget what it is, it's about $1.6 billion a year currently, if you believe the World Bank as opposed to the EU. The EU puts it higher, but they include service trade in that. And the problem...
So where is that being financed now?
This is simple. If you then look at the data on one FDI... which is the last data available, it's about 973 million. And then you look at remittance, which is about 600 million or so, 650. Basically, 806. I'm looking at my notes, I apologize, I'm cribbing. It balances out and you end up with a slight surplus combining capital account and current account. Fine. So, to answer your question, FDI is very important. It's still a considerable amount below where it was in 2007. And I suspect this may be a rough year for FDI because of political risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you're not going to open an automobile factory in Tel Aviv in an election year where you're likely to have either a transfer of power or a civil war. Yeah. I mean,
next year is also an election year.
So absolutely. So it's going to be...
We don't say civil war on the show, so you know. Yeah, okay. Sorry. Election year, you can say. Okay. You can't say civil war. It freaks people out, you know. Foreign investors, strike that from the record.
Okay, we'll call it good.
Anybody who wants to build a car plant in Tel Aviv, you know, come on down.
But hey, the great thing was the Georgians avoided this, you know, and it's a great credit to them. But the point is that both of these, the remittance variable and the FDI variable, are highly dependent on what we love to call exogeneities. You know, basically, people invest less when the global economy is in a mess, right? So, and people, if you have higher and higher unemployment in the areas where the Georgians who send remittances live, there's pressure on that variable.
Like Greece, for example.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's pretty high risk in sustaining the actually marginally positive external balance.
That's a good point.
In the U.S., we call it self-deportation, I believe. So.
Absolutely.
can I ask a quick question? Why... getting a loan from a Georgian bank is extremely expensive. We have seen slight deflation, actually, over the past year.
Yes.
But a Georgian bank, if you put them a lari, dollar, or euro account, they pay you up to 8% in a year, even more of interest. Yeah. Why haven't we seen a lot of investors who don't have investment opportunities abroad give their money and put their money in such an account? I mean, these banks are backed by the World Bank, the IMF, the German government.
I think that there are two factors in play there. One is that, you know, Georgia is a pretty small market, okay? And trading across the line into Armenia and Azerbaijan is not entirely straightforward. And so it's basically small scale.
Mm.
The other one, I mean, essentially, is political risk. It's not so much, I mean, basically one reason for this discount effect is to get people to invest.
Right.
It's working better than it did in 2009. It may not be working as well next year because of the factors we've already discussed. This, by the way, gets me to the capital account. Debt. Debt is an intriguing variable. Georgia has an entirely moderate public sector debt.
Mm-hmm.
It's well within the bounds, and it's, in terms of percent of GDP, is way below such eminently stable countries as the United States, France, and so on. But the real issue on debt here is private, unsecured debt. And they're actually pretty high. And when you put it all together, you probably come in around, currently, the public debt stock plus the private debt stock is about $9.2 billion on a GDP of about $14.4 billion. It's sort of in the 70% range. I mean, it's getting a bit sticky. The question is, what happens to private debt if things go badly? It runs, there's a run on the currency, there will be and runs on the banks. We're not supposed to say this.
Exactly.
On this program. I apologize. And you could end up with a serious economic situation on the debt side as well. Although public sector debt is very much under control, as is the state budget deficit. You know, they're running, I don't know, 3% or something. I forget. I mean, I was looking at next year, and they're planning, I think, on 2.6% or 2.3%. I don't really remember the number. But, I mean, it's, you know, there are a lot of good things in the Georgian economy. That's a stable currency. The budget is a stable budget so far, so long as people don't get out of hand in funding health care and social issues. Monetary stability, inflation, as you said, is negative. This is short-term okay. I wouldn't want to play that in the long term because it depresses unemployment, among other things. And by the way, there's one other positive thing for the future. Why didn't small and medium-sized businesses make substantial profits in Georgia in the past? It's because you got the financial police on your back. And then you went to the city court, and then you plea bargained away with the extra you'd earned. If that goes away, there's a lot of scope for people to be more entrepreneurial at that level than they were before. So,
let's hope it happens. What about, talk a little bit about agriculture and health policies, education. What kinds of things do you think should be happening there?
Well, I mean, agricultural recovery is, to my mind, from the point of view of poverty and unemployment, absolutely essential. It goes back to that 47% in the rural sector, basically producing 7 to 8% of GDP. No wonder they're poor. Georgia has, as everybody says, and in this case it happens to be true, Georgia has huge agricultural potential, particularly if you open the market to the north, which the Russians seem to be talking about now.
And they
not
have
least
to
because
do it,
of WTO.
Yeah.
Well, actually, they would say, this is very simple. They would say, well, we don't have an embargo on Georgia. It's just that Georgian products don't meet our health specification. That will be relaxed because it will be watched. So agriculture will open. That creates an automatic market-based or demand-based boost. But there's a lot of scope for improving agricultural infrastructure, improving markets for agricultural products, improving transport for agricultural products. You know as well as I do. You go to Cajete in the summer, you see all of these ladies with these huge vats of tomatoes sitting by the side of the road as everybody rolls by. Why are they there? Why aren't they in a market and refrigerated to get there?
Yeah.
This is pretty straightforward stuff.
What in terms of health? I mean, is there hope for, you know, whatever the health policy was of the former government, which seemed to be kind of a vague American copy and insurance and, you know, whatever else? I mean, or do we need a national health insurance sort of British style, or what needs to happen there?
Well, the bottom line on health to me is that the current system is effectively excluding large numbers of people from necessary health care. We know this. Frankly, Mark, I don't care whether it's socialized medicine or private mechanism, some kind of private health system, which is universal, doesn't matter to me. I think that if the government really does need to deal with the question of access, particularly for poor people, and particularly in rural areas, it's expensive, it won't come soon. But I think there needs to be evidence of progress on this fairly quickly. Because I don't know about you guys, but I mean, I talk to Georgians. This is something they get irritated by, and significantly.
True. Yeah. Okay, we'll finish up with a last question. The head of the National Bank, as the central bank is called here, Mr. Kadagidze, says he's going to stick around for a while. If you were advising him on what to do. He doesn't write the budget. He just deals with the things the National Bank deals with. May not involve insurance for a while. What would you tell him?
Well, I think there are going to be inflationary pressures in Georgia over the next year or two because of, again, exogenous circumstances, not least the rise in global food prices. And this is about the weather in places like Kansas and in places like Kazakhstan and so on. You know, basically in 2011, when we had that spike of inflation, it very closely tracked the delivery price of wheat in poti. And basically, because Georgia is so import-dependent in food, there's an automatic translating effect into local inflation. The bank presumably doesn't want inflation, and I suspect the government would not want inflation on basic parts of the consumer food basket. So basically, it's control of money supply. You need to keep, and they're doing a good job on that, and that needs to continue.
Control money supply. All right, that's good. Well, let's, you know, if anybody starts to tell him not to control the money supply, as happens, then let's, you know, let's hope that he marks your words. Neil McFarland, thank you very much. We'll now move to the GeoCapital number. As full disclosure, I'm a shareholder. GeoCapital gives us a number each week. This one is 55.5%, which is the percentage of students in Georgian higher education institutions that are female, according to Geostat. In a report called Men and Women in Georgia, that's roughly similar to the United States, where it is 56.8% of students. However, a majority of full professors are male. Announcements. Colga Movies this week. Tomorrow, Friday, is Cutamel from 2007. Monday, December 10th, is Chinatown, 1974. Wednesday, December 12th, is 25th Hour, 2002. So you could go to that right after Lasha Bakradze's discussion nearby at ISET. All movies are 8 p.m. at Dom Kino near Rustaveli Metro. The 13th Tbilisi International Film Festival opened on Monday and will last until this coming Sunday. For a list of films, check tbilisifilmfestival.ge.
It seems to be largely sold out, but maybe you're lucky and find something.
Go and scalp.
All right, yeah, you can scalp. Always show up. On 2012 Tbilisi Fashion Week will take place December 14th to 16th at the Holiday Inn. I wonder if Tata Bakradze's wife is going to be running this one again. For more information, go to Tbilisi Fashion Week page on Facebook. There'll be a Christmas expo Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Sheraton Metehi Palace, where you can enjoy shopping and refreshments while supporting the International Women's Association of Georgia. For more information, check out IWA.GE. It is a complete mob scene at that place. But there is an incredible amount of stuff for sale. There's also a lot of good. There's also a lot of good food to get.
Fun for children to bring.
Yeah, kids love it.
And if anybody wants to see what I look like, you can come and visit the Rotary International table, and I will be there.
Exactly. Yeah, I've had a lot of people ask me what you.
Since
what
I seem to
like.
Never be here when the filming happens.
Exactly. All right. TI Georgia, the hardest working NGO in Georgia, will present its research about the construction company CenterPoint property fraud at noon, December 10th. 2012 at the Radisson Hotel. We hope you'll all show up. For the entire month of December, anybody who comes and tries Betsy's Hotel's new dinner menu will receive a free car wash. Come anytime between 7 and 9 p.m., park out front, and head into reception. Say you want your car washed, and it'll be clean by the time you get out. They'll give you a little piece of paper, get the waiter or waitress to sign it. That's it for this week. My Twitter address is at TXTBUK. Our email address is tbilpod@gmail.com or post to the forum on our website, www.tbilpod.com. This week we'll finish with Dave Brubeck from 1959 and Take Five, the inspiration for which came from an Istanbul street musician. By the way, take it away, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you.